this Monday, June 4th. Sunny, breezy, and warm. High today, 78. Winds up to 30 miles per hour. Winds are picking up a little bit now. Wind from the west-northwest at 10. Sunny and 62 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 810, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com.
Needless to say, one of the predominant topics before the American public right now concerns our neighbor to the south, Mexico, and the relationship between Mexico and the United States, and what is ahead for our two countries, particularly given some of the very aggressive, strong rhetoric coming from President Donald Trump. But beyond that, what are the relative opinions of ordinary people in the United States and Mexico? How do we view each other across our border? And does it make a difference where you live or what you do or who you are? And in what ways are our two countries, that is the United States and Mexico, already connected in ways that are perhaps all but impossible to completely untangle, whatever your political perspective might be on divisive issues like immigration? All of that and more is explored in a fascinating new book called Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. In this book, Andrew Seeley, who himself has a very interesting personal story, explores all kinds of different aspects of life in our two countries and explores a number of different ways in which the United States and Mexico are inextricably tied together, related in all kinds of ways involving culture and our economies and our political life and so on. And I really appreciate the care with which he has written this book. Andrew Seeley is president of the Migration Policy Institute, a former executive vice president of the Woodrow Wilson Center, and founder of its Mexico Institute, an Andrew Carnegie Fellow. His writing has appeared in all kinds of places, including the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. And he writes a regular column, which appears in Mexico's largest newspaper, El Universal. Again, his new book, published by Public Affairs, is called Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. Andrew Seeley, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be with you. You know, they say you get to choose your friends and your allies, but you don't get to choose your neighbors. And, you know, Mexico and Canada, they're our neighbors in the end. So it's a time to figure out how we want to deal with them.
Absolutely. And, of course, whatever one might think of our current president and his own attitudes regarding Mexico and immigrants from Mexico, there is no question that much of what has been said has really fueled new and deeper debates about the relationship between the two countries, and just about anybody should welcome the opportunity for us to be talking about this greater. Ahead of us talking specifically about your book, I would really appreciate it if you would talk for a moment about your own interesting relationship personally with the nation of Mexico.
Sure. I mean, I ended up being connected to Mexico because I ended up living there after college. I had spent some time traveling in Latin America and elsewhere in Europe and elsewhere. But I, you know, ended up after college being invited to work with the Mexican YMCA. The Mexico has, you know, Y like the U.S., actually. I mean, much like it, except in Tijuana, Mexico, right on the border, where they had started a program attending migrant youth, kids who were trying to cross the border or who were wandering. I mean, quite often they would get kids who were, you know, on their way to try and cross, but really were didn't have any family members with them. And they were starting some work in communities on the outskirts of Tijuana, in what were really shanty towns, actually now quite developed areas, but at the time were really shanty towns that had recently been started, didn't have electricity and water. And so I moved down there to work with the Y, and I went for a couple of years, and I stayed for almost 6 years, actually. And in many ways, my life has been connected to Mexico one way or another since then, though I've done a lot of other things. It was an important experience. And for me, actually, one of the things I learned along the way is, you know, living on the border is how connected both sides of the border are. And the more I kept coming back as I did other things along the way, the more I realized that it wasn't just a border story, but the United States and Mexico were connected. And somewhere along the way, actually back in the United States, actually in Washington, D.C., actually, you know, met a young woman and who was from Mexico, and we got married. And so we've gone back and forth for personal reasons as well as at times for professional reasons. I've told people from time to time that I study Mexico because I live it at home. I study the U.S.-Mexico relationship because I live it at home. And that's at least partially true. I mean, you know, to some extent we have to navigate some of these differences in the way we see the world in our family, but also, you know, just from having lived on the border and then worked on the larger relationship, you just see how connected the two countries are, and we don't realize it most of the time.
Right. And where is it that you and your wife and three children live now? I mean,
we live in Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay.
We live in Washington, D.C., and she's originally from near Acapulco, actually, but her family's in Mexico City, and so we go back fairly often as we can for family reasons, but, you know, I've come and gone for professional reasons as well and done research. I think I say this in the book. I mean, I've done research on both sides of the border a lot. But, you know, at one point I did a lot of research in Mexico. And then I came back and started doing research in the United States about how Mexico was influencing the United States and on immigration in the U.S. And it was sort of great then beginning to put the two halves together and saying, well, there's a real story here about, you know, how deeply each country influences the other. And yet most of us don't realize it most of the time. Most of us think that, you know, we can do without the other country. We don't really need that neighbor. But the reality is we've actually become really tied at the hip in that you know, it's partially because we're neighbors, but now goes far beyond that.
Right. I noticed in the introduction that you you say that you are the son of a Danish immigrant mother.
Yes.
And when we look at your photograph, you look like you're Danish by background. In other words, we just look at you and we know that you are not born and raised in Mexico or not yourself in any way Mexican American or Latin American. I mean, you just don't look like it. Which only prompts this question. At one point in the book, you talk about how Mexico is actually never been a country that's had all that many immigrants, although there's a whole chapter devoted to the million or so U.S.-born citizens who actually now make their home in Mexico. But,
yes.
But generally speaking, it is not a nation of immigrants anything like the way the United States is, and that sometimes Mexico has had, in a sense, kind of an uneasy relationship with the people from other countries who have lived there, and vice versa. What was it like for you, especially for someone who, at a glance, clearly is not from Mexico, living and working in Mexico? What were your own personal experiences along that line?
You know, I spent a lot of time proving to people that I could fit in Mexico, even though everyone knew immediately that I wasn't Mexican. And I fortunately speak the language very well. I ironically, in Denmark, everyone thinks I'm Danish until I open my mouth, and my Danish is terrible. In Mexico, you know, I can talk to someone over the phone, and they think I'm Mexican, and then they see me, and they go, wait a minute, you're not Mexican? You know, so I have the opposite problem, actually. But you know, I spent a lot of time, and this is what happens, you know, for those that are listening that are immigrants, I mean, you know what I'm talking about. This happens a lot for people who make America their home. And fortunately, the U.S. is, you know, we still are a country of immigrants in many ways, and we'll talk about that. But, you know, we do have a template for really receiving people from around the world. You can become American no matter where you were born. But there is, you know, when you're an immigrant anywhere, there is an element in which you still have to prove that you are fully integrated in the society. And I didn't plan to become a Mexican citizen, but I lived there long enough. You know, after, you know, I got to maybe 4 years, 5 years, you know, I really wanted to show that I had integrated, that I, you know, I wasn't just passing through, that I actually was, you know, a at least for the time being. I probably never thought I was going to live there forever, but you know, the time I was there, that was pretty integrated in the society. And I look back at myself, and I was a little defensive at times, actually. You know, I was, people would say, you know, are you, where are you from? I'm like, well, I live here. You know, and you sort of just let people hang and, you know, let them see if they want to probe any further. You know, there was a little bit of that, but it was also fun. And the thing I used to tell people about Tijuana particularly, which is a border city, is that everyone in the end is from somewhere in Tijuana. It's a little bit like, you know, going to, you know, California in some ways, maybe 20 years ago, where everyone had a sort of their own migration story of how they got to California. So people would start off, you know, prying about who I was and why I was there. And at some point I'd turn the tables and say, so how'd you get to Tijuana? And everyone had a story. They were from, you know, most were Mexican. A few were actually turned out to be Central American or have an American grandparent. But most were Mexican. But they had all come from somewhere else or their parents had. And we'd end up having these great migration stories, talking with each other about how we ended up in this border city.
Mm. We're speaking with Andrew Seeley about his book, Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. You have written this book. It is published at, in a sense, a really propitious time. That is when so many Americans right now are talking about the United States and Mexico and our relationship and what it has been and what it should be. And so your book is really well-timed in so many respects. Can you just say a word about its timeliness and about the fact that you are highlighting something that is very much unknown to a whole lot of Americans?
Yeah, when I started writing this, it was before the elections, and I didn't think it was going to be as timely as it is, actually. I mean, I knew it was timely, but I didn't think it was quite as timely as it is. And clearly, you know, I think a lot of how we are coming to terms with Mexico, the question about whether we should build a wall on the border or withdraw from NAFTA or, you know, what we do with immigration in this country. These are debates, you know, about ourselves, actually, in the future of the United States. And, you know, I tell my friends in Mexico sometimes that, you know, when we talk about you, we're only partially talking about you. In some ways, it's about us. And I think that's true. We're at a time where people in the United States, some people in the United States, are uncomfortable with globalization. Some are very comfortable. I mean, actually, studies tell us that probably most people are actually happy with the direction of globalization and with trade, and you know that because they're doing okay with it. But there's a strong, significant number of people in the United States whose fortunes have declined in recent years, or are afraid that they may decline, and globalization looks like one of the culprits. Most Americans are very in favor of immigration. People debate how people should come in and which people should come in, and those are legitimate debates to have, by the way. But most people are actually think immigration is an important part of American society. But there are some people also, and it's often an overlapping group, who feel uncomfortable with immigration either because it's changing the demographics around them or because they fear job competition at a time where jobs are changing and industries are changing, and they have legitimate fears about, you know, what work's going to look like 10 years from now for them. And so immigration adds to the fire of other concerns around automation and trade and other things. So this has really hit the point where, you know, my argument in the book is that our integration with Mexico is to our benefit. It's actually helped our economy. It's helped our culture. It's helped Mexico as well. I mean, we're interdependent. We can't get away from it anyway. But in fact, it's been good for us. But there are people who have real concerns. And the president, you know, Donald Trump, is someone who rode to office in part by speaking to those concerns. And part of his strongest base, maybe not most of his supporters, but his strongest base, are people who are very concerned about immigration and trade and America's role in the world more generally. And, you know, Mexico has become the convenient country to talk about. If you can build a wall on the border with Mexico, maybe you can build a wall around the United States.
Mm. Before we dig into some specifics, I want to just point out one thing that I appreciate you acknowledging. It's a point in the book, I can't find it right now, where you're talking about U.S. opinion about Mexico and Mexicans, and you point out that a certain Gallup poll showed much more positive opinion than a somewhat similar poll from just a few years earlier. That is more positive opinion in terms of Americans towards Mexico and Mexicans. However, you acknowledge the fact that the question in that latter Gallup poll was worded a little differently than the question in the earlier poll. And it just underscored the fact that a whole lot turns on how a phrase is worded, and yeah. that you could poll Americans and ask them about Mexico, and just by the way the question is framed, you could really elicit much more positive or much more negative responses. I wonder if you could just acknowledge that reality and just talk about the care with which you have tried to talk about statistics, because certainly yeah. statistics can be manhandled and mishandled and skewed and used to make a point which they really cannot legitimately make. How have you tried to use statistics in this book?
Yeah, I mean, I've tried to use them, I mean, exactly as you say, very cautiously. And I've tried to be respectful of differences of opinion. I mean, what it is not a book about Donald Trump. I mean, he's mentioned a handful of times in the book, but I resisted the temptation to make this a diatribe or, you know, because I have a lot of friends who voted for Donald Trump. So I don't want to, you know, I want readers who have different political persuasions to be able to read this and wrestle with the arguments. And frankly, I think people are right to have conflicted opinions about Mexico. I mean, as much as I will tell you it has been an overall positive for us, it is, you know, and Mexicans are right to have conflicted opinions about us, which they do as well. It is not an uncomplicated relationship. And I used to, you know, at a time when I was working on U.S.-Mexico relations as my day job, I had a colleague working on U.S.-Canada relations, and we used to get together and complain, you know, each in our own way. And her complaint was that no one pays attention. Everyone loves Canada, but no one pays attention to Canada. You know, you convene a meeting about U.S.-Canada relations, and you get three people in the room. You know, you go up to the Hill to talk about Canada, there's no interest. You know, maybe that's changing now with NAFTA, but you know, at the time, you know, Canada is kind of, we like them, but we don't really know much about them. You convene a meeting about Mexico, and you get lots of people and lots of controversy, right? And in some ways, that makes sense, you know, because although there's a lot of really good things happening, I mean, you look at Hollywood, four of the last five, you know, Oscar-winning directors are Mexican. You know, incredible. There's a lot of stuff going on in the innovation community, doing Silicon Valley in Mexico. You know, there's a lot of manufacturing that's happening where workers on both sides of the border are working together. Lots of good stuff going on. It's an unequal relationship. You know, Mexico is a country that still has a lot of poverty. It's a country that still has a lot of corruption. There's some positive signs that people are cleaning that up and that people are less tolerant, but it's still there. The government doesn't work as well. It works better than it did 20 years ago, but it's still got its issues. And, you know, there is a great deal of inequality, and there still are some people, fewer than before, but there are few people that still want to leave the country. You know, on the flip side, for Mexicans, they look at us and they see us as the sort of overbearing, you know, brother, as the country that would like to tell them what to do. And they recognize a lot of good things about the United States, but every time there's a sit-down conversation, Americans are trying to convince them about something or trying to get their way with them, and they worry about, you know, maybe they should actually just pull out of this relationship and not deal with us. And look, it's a complicated relationship. I mean, it really is. And one of the things I look at in the book is, you know, there's actually, when you look at the economic relationship, there's a lot of jobs that have been created, and we can talk more about this, far more than have been lost. But it doesn't mean the jobs haven't been lost. And I have a story in there, actually, about the last big nail factory in the United States. It's in southeastern Missouri, in Poplar Bluff, Missouri. And a Mexican company comes in and saves the nail industry, the American nail industry, the largest factory by far in the United States of nails, and continues to produce with American workers. And it's a great story of, you know, Mexican investment saving American jobs. But one of the things I mentioned, because I learned this when I went to look at the story, is that right around the corner was another factory that had making air conditioners, and it had closed a few months before the Mexican company came in. And I can tell you there's a net job gain in that city, but that doesn't help the people that lost their jobs because the air conditioning factory went to Mexico. And there is some of that happens as well. So net gains may be great overall, but net gains aren't good if it disrupts your job or if it disrupts your spouse's job or your brother or sister's job.
Right.
You know, and both of those things happen in this relationship.
Right. And I appreciate the fact that you acknowledge sort of the painful aspect of this as forthrightly as you do. I think it's very easy to kind of pay lip service to that before rushing on to what one thinks of as one's main point, but there's all these good things that are happening. And I really think your book does a pretty good job of not rushing through the painful part, which in a sense, you know, you would perhaps be tempted to do if this was a book that was meant to paint a simplistic picture. You're really trying to show this complicated relationship in all its complexity.
Very much so. And it is complicated. I mean, you know, immigration is complicated for that matter. I mean, you know, lots of long-term gain for, you know, innovation in our country, for, you know, really positive cultural changes, for learning from the world. It's part of what's made us so competitive in the global economy, and why the U.S. will still be competitive 20 years from now is that, you know, immigration has given us this template for understanding the world and for competing in the world. And overall, the studies tell us that it's a net good for the economy. But there's a lot of dislocations that come with immigration. I mean, there is probably some competition at the local level for jobs, and there certainly is when people move in, you know, when you have a large scale. And I have a story of Hazleton in the introduction, which was a city that went from having very little immigration to being about half immigrant today, from Mexico and Dominican Republic and other countries. You know, the city's done very well. It's a city that's very dynamic. Actually, the downtown has come back. I mean, lots of good things have happened. But they also went through a lot of strains on public services in the short term, and particularly in the earlier years. You know, how do you adjust to, you know, students who don't speak English? You know, what do you do in the emergency room when some of your patients don't speak English? You know, what do you do if your student speaks English but the parents don't and you need to communicate with the parents? You know, these are questions that, so, you know, immigration itself is not uncomplicated. Trade is certainly not uncomplicated. Border communities aren't uncomplicated. I mean, all these things come with, you know, we can say they're net goods and we can say they're great for us in the long term, and I don't doubt they are. I mean, I'm making the point that they are because I think they are, but it's worth acknowledging that there are bumps on the road to get there. And for the Mexicans, too. I mean, the fact that so many people left Mexico, you know, was also tough for a lot of communities in Mexico. I mean, Mexican companies, at the same time we complain about people, you know, companies moving to Mexico for cheaper work, Mexicans complain about the fact that U.S. companies came in with free trade and knocked their companies out of business, which is true as well. A lot of big, you know, U.S. established U.S. companies came in and knocked out domestic manufacturers. In the long run, we'll all be okay. In the long run, we'll probably all be better off, but that doesn't help people that are affected in the short term.
We're speaking with Andrew Seeley about his book, Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. You begin your book in a really interesting place, namely San Diego, California, and Tijuana, Mexico, and the fact that these two cities, these two important cities, share an airport, and most of us do not know that. First of all, explain sort of the reason why San Diego needed to turn to its neighbor to the south when it came to the matter of its own airport and its need for expansion.
Well, it's a great story. I mean, this I lived in San Diego and Tijuana most of the 1990s, and these were two very different cities. I mean, San Diego was kind of an insular, beautiful beach town. Tijuana was this rough and tumble, you know, rising industrial town. And one of the things that was on the airwaves constantly was this debate about where to put an airport, because San Diego knew that they couldn't expand the main airport they had, which is downtown. And so they needed to build a bigger airport sooner or later. And as San Diego got into the 2000s, they started to realize that they wanted to compete as an innovation center. They started to actually have some real good technological and medical inventions that they could, you know, push out. And these kept leaving town, moving to places that had better connection to Asia and to Latin America. And so they just really intensified. And at some point along the way, city leaders in San Diego and city leaders in Tijuana had started to talk to each other about other things. And Tijuana had become a much more – San Diego had become a less insular city, and Tijuana had become much more of a middle-class city, actually, much more sophisticated. And at some point as they were talking to each other, they realized that the answer was the Tijuana airport, which is right on the border. Tijuana has a large airport with long runways. It's right on the border. And what they ended up doing was building a bridge across they built a bridge across the border fence. And it's a great metaphor, among other things. I mean, you know, it's sort of the metaphor of the book of the bridges across the wall. But they literally physically built in 2015 a bridge that goes across. So you can check into the airport. If you're coming from San Diego, you check in on the U.S. side. You can check in English if you want, as though you're in your own U.S. airport terminal. You walk across. You do have to show your passport as you were walking across. And you very quickly go through immigration and customs. And then you go to your gate. But it's almost as though you're in the United States. I mean, it's amazingly, they've made the experience amazingly similar. And it was a really creative way to actually get the two cities working together. And one of the things, I mean, San Diego is, you think, has a bunch of California hippies out there, but as a matter of fact, San Diego is actually a fairly conservative city, mostly has had Republican mayors. And it was just a very pragmatic response of two cities that discovered each other. And then they started to realize that the more they did things together, the more they had a bigger economy and a bigger set of assets that they could play with. And Tijuana had developed a great some wine country to the south and a great restaurant scene, a good orchestra. It became an interesting city, actually, along the way. And so the people were going back and forth anyway to sample the culture on the other side. And they started talking about other things they could do. And so increasingly you had San Diego and Tijuana talking about, can they host an Olympics together? You know, could they get involved in the World Cup? Could they, what can they do together that maximizes, what sort of industries can they put, factories on both sides of the border, pieces of the operation on both sides of the border? It's become a very integrated metro area. And oddly enough, being sort of the son of a Dane, what it reminds me of, for anyone that's ever been to Copenhagen, Copenhagen sits right across a bridge from Malmö, Sweden, which is a giant city in Sweden, and they become sort of a big metro area. And it's oddly similar, actually. These are two cities in two different countries, but people move back and forth with incredible ease, and the economies are incredibly linked, and they do all these creative things together now.
Interesting. Although it's interesting, you quote at least one official who laments the fact that it isn't easier to cross the border, and he thinks that probably certain people are discouraged from crossing that border to eat in a restaurant in Tijuana or whatever because the lines often are quite long and the process actually can be quite slow to cross that border between San Diego and Tijuana.
Yeah, that is true, too. I mean, because they've now started doing things together, and it's actually kind of easier to cross the border, but the demand to make it even quicker has grown. I mean, I actually remember the first time I tried to – I just moved to Tijuana. The following week, I had to go to a meeting in San Diego, and it took me 2 hours to cross the border, actually. I missed the meeting in the end because I just had no sense that it could take that long to cross a border. It's gotten a lot better, at least for people who are frequent border crossers. There are ways of getting across quicker. But the reality is, even though it's gotten quicker, the integration has just gotten much more intense and needs to be even quicker to keep up with that. It still falls behind, what's possible. Because in the end, people do move back and forth. And I have an interview in there. I don't think I've put it fully in there, but there's someone I mentioned it in there. But there's someone I interviewed who was a lot of fun, actually. I interviewed a few companies that were binational. And one of the more fun interviews was someone from Parker Industries, which makes commercial boxes, actually, commercial crates for shipping, a lot of them for the U.S. military as well as for private industry. And they actually have an R&D team on both sides of the border. So they're constantly being commissioned to do things. They need certain kinds of shipping crates, and they have to design them. And half their R&D team is in Tijuana, half of it's in San Diego. And you get lots of things like that in that border area. And so it actually matters, even if it takes 45 minutes to get across. It doesn't take 2 hours anymore, but it could take you a half hour, 45 minutes. That's lost time, right? And it's inefficient. So that still matters.
Hmm. I'm really anxious to look up a photo of this bridge between San Diego and Tijuana that takes people over to the airport. You call it a monument to the new relationship emerging between the two border cities, which increasingly resemble a single metropolitan area, a powerful symbol of how the two cities have been overcoming the distance that once existed between them.
Yeah, it really is. It looks like something out of a Star Wars set. It is a very modern, as you'd expect, it's a very modern bridge. And by the way, it was built by a private company. Part of the deal to make this happen was the U.S. government would only give the permit for this if it would be built by a private company, but they would also pay for all of the costs for border inspectors and customs officials and immigration officials who have to man in perpetuity the bridge. And so it was actually built by a private company. It's now recovered a large part of their investment, and about 4 million people have crossed this. So it's getting a lot of use. But it really looks modern. And below it, actually, I remember the first time I went there, I took a picture of it. Below it is what we call the border wall, which is actually a fence. And it's this sort of rusted fence beneath it. And it's really a powerful image because it is such a modern-looking, you can sort of tell where the future's headed, and it's not the border fence.
I want to ask you about one other thing in this fascinating chapter about San Diego and Tijuana. You talk about, at one point, actually you're quoting somebody as saying that Tijuana has always been much more horizontal than other places in Mexico. That's such an intriguing notion. And I think it's worth talking about because we're here not just to talk about Tijuana, but all of Mexico. And maybe by kind of exploring what this gentleman is talking about, we can come away with a better sense of what Mexico is like, and then how Tijuana, at least in this respect, is a bit different from the rest of the country.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and the person who told me this is actually a good friend of mine named Tonatiuh Guillen, someone I've ended up, I knew him as an academic that I went to interview years ago, and we ended up becoming good friends along the way. And he's a fascinating guy because he himself is from the child of migrants from Oaxaca, mostly indigenous state in mostly Native American state in Mexico, who moved to the border. He actually grew up in a different border city in Ciudad Juarez. And he ends up becoming, after I had met him, he ends up becoming the president of one of the most prestigious universities in Mexico, which is in Tijuana. And, you know, one of the things he has said to me all along is this would not have happened in some other places in Mexico. I mean, the reality is, you know, I grew up in a working class family in a rough, you know, border town. And, you know, here I am the president of a university years later, you know, and you can do this in Tijuana. It's a bit of a frontier city, you know, and the north of Mexico has been that, and the larger cities, Mexico City is a bit of a frontier city as well. The places that people move to, Guadalajara, which I talk about in the book, is sort of the center of the innovation, the tech innovation industry, is increasingly becoming a settler city as well, with lots of people moving in. And these are cities where the traditional hierarchies have started to break down. I mean, Mexico was in many places you know, not a settler society. It was a society where it was colonized, right, where people came in and, you know, it was rural, large tracts of land, a few people who took the benefit of that. And those relationships get passed down even after Mexico stops being an agricultural society. It still remains very hierarchical, right? It's hard to be born poor and then move up in the hierarchy, either in terms of, you know, getting a good government job and becoming an important politician, or, you know, growing up in the business community or wherever it is, or in the university, becoming a prestigious professor. Always people that did it, but it was always the exception. The frontiers of Mexico, particularly the northern border area and much of the north and a couple of the largest cities, are increasingly changing that. You know, and I think that's one of the big changes that's going on in Mexico, is these hierarchies are breaking down. My wife is actually, you know, if I can put her on the spot for this, I mean, she's a bit an example of this as well. I mean, she came from what I would call a lower middle class family in a small town in the poorest state of Mexico, ends up as a teenager in Mexico City. Her father decides to move the family out of the state. He's not from there, and he has gotten a job in Mexico City, and so he moves the family to Mexico City. And really, I mean, he'd been commuting to Mexico City, but he just decides he doesn't want his three daughters growing up in a state that's still very hierarchical and where young women marry at an early age, moves them to Mexico City. And for her, it's eye-opening. I mean, she will say, you know, Mexico City was, for her, a world of opportunities and a place where you could really make your future. And she ends up in the United States on a PhD program down the road. You know, these are things that happen in frontier societies, and it's a lot of the history of the United States, right? I mean, with all of our problems and with the questions about whether it's becoming social mobility may be slowing down, and there are reasons to think that's true in the United States. But we've had social mobility in part because we're a frontier society. We're a society, you know, and with slavery and with lots of things that have happened that have built hierarchies in the U.S. And, you know, they're not trivial at all. They're huge. But nonetheless, there is a template for people moving up and for making who you are out of your character and your entrepreneurship that still sticks in the society. And that's beginning in Mexico. It's beginning in a lot of really key places in a way that wasn't true necessarily 20 or 30 years ago.
And Tijuana would be one example of such a
place. Very much so. Yeah. I mean, Tijuana is the furthest city you can get from Mexico City. And so in that sense, it is the, you know, it's the epitome of being outside of the realm of power, but it has also made it one of the more prosperous cities in Mexico now, because people were able to take that and do really creative things. And now you're seeing much of that happening in the rest, particularly in the north of Mexico in the big cities, you know, and in some smaller towns as well.
We, of course, need to talk about NAFTA, and you explore the issues related to NAFTA quite thoroughly in the second chapter of the book. First of all, since NAFTA is so much in the news right now, I think it's worth our talking about this trade agreement, which President Trump is on record as calling the worst trade agreement ever. And of course, right now he is in the process of allowing certain tariffs to go ahead involving both our neighbors to the north and south, Canada and Mexico. And it's calling into question the relationship between these nations that share the continent. You tell us that, in fact, it is a complicated relationship, but one that has remained quite positive for all concerned, including the United States. What's most important for us right now to understand about the trade relationship between the U.S. and Mexico?
I think there's two things. I mean, one is Mexico is a big export market for the U.S. It's the second biggest export market after Canada. We trade a lot with China, but we mostly import stuff from them. But Canada and Mexico we actually export to. So for American farmers, for example, Mexico is a huge, huge market for soybeans and corn, for pork, to some extent for beef, and for lots of other crops. So it's a big export market. But more importantly than that, probably, although that's huge, is in the industrial economy, we actually build things together. And the best place to see this is in cars. You know, for those that are old enough to remember, you know, the 1980s and the early 1990s, we worried about, you know, American car companies being put out of business by Japanese imports, right? Japanese, German, and some of the Korean imports were just going to wipe out the big three. And it's not what happened. What actually happened is that most, you know, foreign car companies that want to sell in the United States actually manufacture in the United States today. There are very few imported cars in the United States. I mean, most cars, if you're going to buy a Honda or you're going to buy a Nissan, you're going to buy a Volkswagen, it's probably been made in the United States. But any car made in the United States has a lot of parts that are made in Mexico and Canada, and particularly in Mexico. It's a very integrated industry across. And there's a slight chance it's made in Mexico. There's some cars, there are more cars made in Mexico, but most cars sold in the U.S. are still made in the U.S. Mexico has lots and lots of parts manufacturing. And what happened is the addition of Mexico and Canada along with the U.S. to the car industry meant that it became much more competitive globally. And it made much more sense for, you know, Nissan or Mazda or Honda or Volkswagen or Fiat to make cars in the United States and in Mexico and in Canada, to make it in North America under NAFTA rules, than to try and make it in their own countries and then send it to the U.S. And it really saved the car industry. And there were other things. I mean, the big three did a good job also in controlling some costs and making smaller cars. Other things happened along the way. But it's a huge tribute to actually what happened as the three economies integrated. So any vehicle you travel in just about in the U.S., and this is somewhat true of – mostly true of trains, certainly of trucks, increasingly true of airplanes, probably has parts from Mexico and Canada as well as from the United States. And this has started to happen in refrigerators. It started to happen in air conditioners and appliances of all sorts, lesser extent in computers as well. We have a really integrated industry. You have people making – NAFTA is yes, about trade and yes, about American exports, but it's a huge amount also about how we make things together across the border. And then there's the question of investment. And there's a chapter in there about how Mexican companies invest in the U.S., and this is a newer phenomenon, but it turns out that Mexican companies actually have been investing a lot of money in the past 10 years in the United States and creating jobs in the United States. And it's somewhat unusual. A lot of industries that we know as American industries are actually supported by Mexican capital these days, which is kind of a fun turnaround from the past. It was true the other direction. There's always been American companies in Mexico, but now suddenly there's Mexican investment supporting U.S. jobs in the United States.
Mm-hmm. This is as good a time as any to point out, and I don't know that it's come up hardly at all in this interview thus far, that your book actually begins in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. And
yes.
And in that introduction, a lot of the issues that we're talking about right now are really spelled out. That is the impact of the relationship between the United States and Mexico as it has played out in a place like Hazleton, Pennsylvania. Can you just say a quick word about why you thought this story was a great place to begin your book?
You know, it was one of that story and the story about San Diego Tijuana were kind of the inspiration for the book. Not actually the border fence, because the border bridge, but to the airport, because that was new. But the story of the connections between San Diego and Tijuana, and then Hazleton really was where I started writing the book. And Hazleton was fascinating because it was the city that had undergone. Hazleton was the city where it was the first city to try and pass local laws, local ordinances that made it illegal to rent an apartment to someone who didn't have legal documents or to give them a job. You could lose your business permit. And those ordinances didn't go anywhere. They were overturned in the courts. But Hazleton really was the symbol of the movement pushing back against immigration in the United States. And this is in 2006. So it is a symbolic value. And as I started to go visit there, one of the things I realized is that there were two Mexican factories, two factories making bread. One was an old Stroman's bakery that had been bought out by a Mexican company, by a group called Grupo Bimbo. They don't really use their name. Bimbo is not a great, you know, it's not a great name to run with in the United States. But it's the name of a little bear that they use as their symbol. It's a play on bambino, and the word for a child. In Italian, but they, you know, they bought out the Stroman's bakery, and then they started manufacturing some of their other products there, which include Sara Lee and Entenmann's and Oro Wheat and Thomas English muffins, and they started another factory. And then along the way, as I was going to Hazel, this is the 25%, more or less 26% of U.S. baked goods are actually made by a Mexican company, but made on U.S. soil by American workers. And then there was a tortilla plant one time. I was going, that was fairly new, and I saw an advertisement for it. And sure enough, Mission Tortillas, which is owned by a Mexican company, was hiring workers in, you know, just outside of Hazleton for this tortilla plant. And then Wise Potato Chips, which is more an East Coast thing. But Wise Potato Chips is the official potato chip of the New York Mets and the Boston Red Sox. And Wise Potato Chips, it turns out, is also owned by a Mexican company. And it's right outside Hazleton. It's about 20 minutes outside Hazleton in another town. And, you know, it's actually expanded. Since it was bought by a Mexican company, it's expanded the workforce by about a quarter or a third and is doing quite well. And there's sort of story after story of this. And ironically, since, you know, we just slapped tariffs on Mexico on steel, I mean, one of the interesting stories in the book is the story of this nail factory that I mentioned, which is sustained by, which is actually bought by a Mexican steel company. And you know, the story was essentially that they were able to be competitive against imported nails because they could combine Mexican steel made in the north of Mexico, not too far away, with the workforce in the United States making the nails. And it became really competitive, particularly against Chinese imports. And it'll be interesting to see what happens now with the steel tariffs.
Mm-hmm. Your book goes on to explore other aspects of our economy in which we would never think of Mexico as being a major player. And this is, of course, especially true when it comes to sort of the high-tech industry. And in the fourth chapter of your book, this is really where you explore quite a lot of this, especially a company, an IT company called Softech, and the practice of what is called nearshoring. Explain what this term is about and what it represents.
Yeah, it's Mexican IT companies, and it's particularly one company, but there are a couple other that have tried to get into this as well. A company called Softech, which is also a female-run company as well, which is fascinating. A woman named Blanca Trevino runs it, but started by a group of people, men and women, who discovered that they could actually do what India does very well. You know, instead of you know, being the IT providers that are halfway around the world and do your business overnight, they could be the IT providers in real time, you know, and on 2 or 3 hour flight away, but they could do it cheaper in Mexico. And so increasingly they've become IT providers for a lot of the Fortune 500 companies in the United States. They're quite successful and quite large now. They work a lot in Latin America as well. They have offices in China and India and in Silicon Valley. I mean, this is a, you know, sort of the new sort of attachment between, you know, and they attract American workers as well as Mexican, mostly Mexican, but, you know, American and Indian and Chinese and other workers to work with them as well. They've been very successful building a you know, world-class tech company right next to the United States. And you know, their argument is we can do this and, you know, you can call us whenever you want because we're in the same time zone and we can get on a plane whenever you need us to. And so it's been, you know, they're not quite where India is, but they really are moving forward. And then you get, I mean, this huge tech industry in Guadalajara, the Mexico's second biggest city. Guadalajara has become this tech capital, which is fascinating. It was, you know, back in the 60s, it really was the manufacturing place for Kodak and for a few other firms and the beginnings of Hewlett-Packard and a few other firms. And through the 70s and 80s, you know, as the computer revolution takes off, it is really successful as a manufacturer. And then those jobs go to Asia, and Guadalajara almost collapses. The economy almost collapses there. And then it bounces back, not by selling itself as a manufacturer, but because they had really started to invest in tech education. You get this new generation of people with tech degrees, and you start seeing these companies put their R&D operations and their design operations and their more sophisticated operations in Guadalajara. And in the last 5 or 6 years, what you've started to see is not just that, but you've started to see startup companies, sort of like Silicon Valley, actually. I mean, it's Mexico's Silicon Valley, where you have all these small startups. And I spent a lot of time, I spent a couple of weeks actually hanging out with startups there and actually working out of an incubator and a group called Hackers and Founders, which is the largest tech network in the world out of Silicon Valley, has its biggest chapter. Actually, its second biggest chapter is in Guadalajara. And so I worked out of their incubator, actually, when I was there. And absolutely fascinating startup culture. I mean, the sort of the same things you see if anyone that's, you know, hung out in Silicon Valley or has friends that moved there and you know, come back and they talk the lingo of Silicon Valley. You know, it's the same environment, actually, and the same connections to universities and to companies. And this, you know, people go to tech meetings every night, to innovation meetings, and talk to each other and talk about their startup ideas and how to raise capital for it and where the niche in the market is. Absolutely fascinating place.
Well, and you talk about some of the big events that occur there around the theme of innovation, especially something that occurs every July. Explain this to our listeners.
Yes, the campus party. The campus party is this 25,000 people get together and talk about tech innovation. And, you know, it is an absolutely fascinating gathering. Almost everyone is in their 20s, a lot of them in their early 20s. And they talk about startups, and they talk about the latest technology, and they bring in people who have started companies around the world. And the great thing, you know, I ended up going, a good friend of mine, Rosana Fuentes Berain, who's a longtime Mexican journalist, but now runs her own startup, actually. She and I went together, and you know, we went out for a tequila afterwards, and we're sitting in the bar. We said, well, first of all, we're the oldest people there. And we're not that old, but, you know, we're clearly the oldest people there. But the second thing we realized, you know, is there was no government presence. This was, you know, in Mexico, historically, the government was everywhere. And part of when I talk about, you know, Tijuana sort of frontier town, one of the things that was different about Tijuana is the government never quite had the same presence. This was much more of an entrepreneurial town always. And increasingly you see this in other places of Mexico. But there was no government presence. I mean, none that you could really notice. There were no government speakers. This was a place where entrepreneurs were meeting other entrepreneurs, mostly Mexicans, but some Americans and some Germans and some Finnish and, you know, some from Japan. This was a true horizontal space where people are meeting each other. And if you've got a good idea and you can make it fly and you can raise some money around it, you know, there's a good chance you could be a successful entrepreneur. And that's a new Mexico. That's a different Mexico than the more hierarchical Mexico that existed 20 or 30 years ago. And it's taken off. I mean, it's really fascinating. I mean, Guadalajara is actually a city that has a lot of really creative startups going on, much like Silicon Valley, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. It's not Silicon Valley of today, but it's the Silicon Valley of 20 or 30 years ago as things, you know, the early 90s maybe, or the mid-90s, as things were really starting to take off.
And, of course, this is exactly the kind of thing that many Americans never dream is possible, that is one aspect of Mexico. They think of Mexico in a way that does not include what you have just described in Guadalajara.
No. Well, one of my favorite stories in the book, actually, is a guy named Bismarck Lepe, who is a very successful Silicon Valley entrepreneur. And he worked at Google. When he went to Stanford, he worked at Google. He was a senior. He did very well at Google. And he goes on, he starts his first company. And he gives his first company a name in out of a South Indian language, actually, because he's thinking, you know, the future of technology is India. You know, and so he's very focused on this. And he's thinking about where he's going to put the operations of the startup. They've gotten funding. They're about to take off. They become actually very successful. He sells it for $410 million in the end. I mean, very successful. And the friend he commissions to go do the study comes back to him and says, and he's thinking India. I mean, you know, we're going to put this company in India or maybe Vietnam. And his friend comes back and says, I think you should put in Guadalajara, Mexico. And his response, I can't remember, I'm paraphrasing it, but is, you know, I had never thought of Mexico because that's the country my parents left when I was a kid. You know, and I never saw it as a land of opportunity. And he is the son of migrant workers. I mean, he was born in the United States, but his parents, when he was a kid, were moving back and forth across the border and in working in the fields in California. And for him, Mexico was a great place for culture. It was a good place for family. But never in his wildest dreams had he thought Mexico was a place that he was going to invest money. And he ends up actually being convinced by his friend, who's not Mexican, has no ties to Mexico. He simply did the study and said, this is the place. If you want to get ahead of the curve, this is the place to go. I mean, all the other places are saturated. This is you're going to be in at the beginnings. And so he ends up putting his company there, actually, and he ends up selling the company. He starts another company, which is Wiseline, which is also incredibly successful, and he has the operations in Guadalajara. And so he's become something of a bridge. I mean, there are a lot of people doing this, but in some ways he's become one of the more visible people as a bridge between Silicon Valley and Guadalajara, trying to to get those conversations going and trying to convince other companies to move down there and see the advantages. And a lot of them have done that.
Hmm. The book is Vanishing Frontiers, The Forces Driving Mexico and the United States Together. And the book is by Andrew Seeley, and the book is published by Public Affairs. Andrew Seeley, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your rich and thoroughly engrossing book. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It was great talking with you.